Now let us start with a new chapter, Romantic Criticism, Coleridge. The first subheading here is Great Poetic Critic, the Fragmentary Nature of His Work. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, 1772 to 1834, was a great poet, but he is also a great critic. He is one of the greatest of poet critics that England has ever produced. He was a genius, and when he was inspired and when the mood was upon him, he could create works of the highest order, but he was incapable of sustained and persistent labor. He could work only by fits and starts, with the result that Ancient Mariner is the only complete thing that he has left behind him. The rest of his work, both in poetry and prose, is fragmentary and incomplete. His literary criticism, says E. Ilbert, is scrappy, quietic, and tentative. In bulk, it is large and sprawling. In manner, it is diffused and involved. But in its happier moments, it possesses a breadth, a depth, and a searching wisdom that are as rare as they are admirable. The other subheading is His Critical Works. Estrée's remarks on literature and literary theory are scattered all over his prose works, as The Friend, Table Talks, Letters, Adds to Reflection, Confessions of an Inquiring Spirit, Anima Poetae, and Sibylline Lips. But the bulk of his literary criticism, all that is most worthwhile in its content, is his Biographia Literaria, and second, Lectures on Shakespeare and Other Poets. Then the other subheading is Lectures on Shakespeare, Practical Criticism. His practical criticism may be divided into three groups. First, criticism on Shakespeare and Milton. Second, criticism on Wordsworth. And third, lectures, notes, etc. on various poets, mainly of the 17th century. Lectures on Shakespeare and Other Poets were delivered by the poet at intervals between 1808 to 1819. As he did not like to deliver a written lecture, they are full of digressions and repetitions, and as they were not published within his lifetime, many of them have been lost, and only about one third of the total output has come down to us. It is unfortunate, says Albert, that they were never prepared for publication by Coleridge himself, and that we have to rely on the imperfect records prepared from notes and reports by his daughter in 1836 and by Penny Collier in 1856. As a result, the lectures as we have them lack the finish of works properly prepared for publication. Coleridge's approach to Shakespeare is, on the whole, impressionistic. Shakespeare's greatness, according to Coleridge, lies not in the richness and details of his observation, but in the wide sympathy that enables him to identify himself with his characters at will. His lectures on Shakespeare show Coleridge as a giant in the rank of English critic. His examination of Shakespeare's plays and the poems by other writers gives us something more than an acute logical dissection according to certain predetermined canons. It is subtly suggestive, stimulating the reader to keener perceptions and formulating for him his own vague, half-crystallized reactions. Every work of art he sees as an organic, developing whole, subject only to the laws of its own existence. A true romantic, Coleridge revolts against the Augustan conception of poetry as an art to instruct. For him, the aim of poetry is to provide pleasure through the medium of beauty. The lectures are impressionistic, romantic criticism of highest order. Coleridge is neither judicial nor legalistic. Rather, he gives his own reactions and responses to the works of Shakespeare, a born genius. Coleridge's work on Shakespeare has never been surpassed, and he is regarded as the ancestor of such great modern Shakespearean critics as Bradley and Wilson Knight. Then, the other subheading of this chapter is Biographia Literaria, Introductory. While lectures on Shakespeare are predominantly devoted to practical criticism, the Biographia Literaria, 1817, is a work on literary aesthetics or literary theory. Practical criticism, there is, Coleridge does analyze particular works now and then, but such analysis is meant to illustrate some particular critical viewpoint of the poet. Biographia Literaria is a work of great value, but it too suffers from the usual faults of Coleridge. As its name signifies, it pretends to be a record of poet's literary upbringing, but there is little consecutive narrative, there is too much of philosophizing and too many side issues and digressions. After 16 chapters of philosophizing, almost entirely irrelevant, he discusses the poetical theory of his friend Wordsworth. And then in the last 7 chapters of the book, he gives a remarkable demonstration of his critical powers. He analyzes the Wordsworthian theory in a masterly fashion and separating the good from the bad, upon the sounder elements bases a critical dogma of great and permanent value. These last chapters of the book, which are the most enduring exposition of the romantic theory as it exists in English, place Coleridge in the first flight of critics. This is the statement of Albert. The next subheading in this chapter is its origin and genesis. Coleridge's letters, written from time to time, throw valuable light on the origin and genesis of the Biographia Literaria. From his letters to his friend Humphrey Davy, it appears that around 1800 the poet intended to write a life of German poet Lessing, and also a treatise on the philosophy of poetry entitled An Essay on the Elements of Poetry. Then an illness intervened and the idea was given up. The poet next planned to write a study of contemporary poetry. It was to be in 2 volumes, and the purpose was to examine what was good in each writer and what were the sources of poetic pleasure. However, this plan too was given up and treatise was never written. But the intention of writing a treatise on aesthetic still persisted, and in 1803 he decided to write the book in an autobiographical form. The book was to contain both his metaphysical and literary theories, but even of this book Not even a single page was written for full 12 years, that is till 1815. The project was seriously undertaken only in 1815 when a publisher friend, J.K. Gutch, advanced him ample money in the hope of getting his works for the publication. Then its plan, its publication. The first part of Biographia Literaria, the philosophical part from chapter 1 to 13, was completed in July 1815. It contained his philosophical and metaphysical theories and their impact on his life. Then he began writing the preface of the book. The preface grew in his hand and was soon as long as the book itself. It now forms the part 2 of Biographia Literaria, chapters 14 to chapter 22, the part which examines critically Wordsworth's theory of poetry and poetic diction, and which is of far-reaching significance as far as literary theory is concerned. The link between the two parts of the poet's theory of imagination. The manuscript was then handed over to the publisher. Coleridge first intended to call the work Autobiographia Literaria, but later changed it to Biographia Literaria. When the book was under print, fresh trouble arose. The publishers had calculated that manuscript contained enough matter for two volumes of 300 pages each. Now it was found that there was not enough matter for the second volume. In order to bring the size of the second part to requisite length, much extraneous and irrelevant matter was added, and the book was at last published in July 1817 after a delay of nearly 2 years. Then its faults, its originality. Biographia Literaria has serious and obvious faults. As pointed out above, there is much in it that is irrelevant and extraneous. There are too many side issues and digressions. Coleridge is often unsystematic and haphazard. There is a strange mixture of philosophy, literary theory, and biography. But still, the Biographia remains a great world book. According to Sainsbury, the whole book is among the few which constitute the very Bible of criticism. The greatness and originality of the book arises from the fact that here, for the first time, a synthesis of philosophy and literature has been achieved. Coleridge has based literary criticism on human psychology. He has used philosophy to explain the process of artistic creation. Thus, the work is a unique landmark in the history of literary criticism. Formative influences on Coleridge. This is the next subheading. Coleridge was a man of wide and comprehensive reading, and a writer's views and attitudes are consciously or unconsciously molded and formed by all that he reads. However, the influences which were most potent in shaping the views and theories of Coleridge are three. First, Wordsworth. Second, Hartley and his associationists psychology, and C, German transcendental and idealistic philosophy of Lessing, Kant, Hegel, Schelling, Schiller, etc. In order to understand Coleridge's own philosophical and literary growth, it is necessary to form an idea of the influences that operated upon him. Then his first work of Wordsworth. Coleridge came in contact with Wordsworth in 1796, quite early in his career and was powerfully influenced by the elder poet. The plan of the lyrical ballads was evolved as a result of their frequent discussions and exchange of views. He himself speaks of the influence of Wordsworth on him in the most glowing terms. "I was in my 24th year," he says, "when I had the happiness of knowing Mr. Wordsworth personally, and while memory lasts, I shall hardly forget the sudden effect produced in my mind by his recitation of a manuscript poem which still remains unpublished. It was the union of deep feeling with profound thought, the fine balance of truth in observing, with the imaginative faculty in modifying the objects observed, and above all, the original gift of spreading the tone, the atmosphere, and with its depth and height of the ideal world around forms, incidents, and situations of which, for the common view, custom had bedimmed, all the lustre had dried up, the sparkle and the dew drops. This excellence, which in all Mr. Wordsworth's writings is more or less predominant, and which constitutes the character of his mind, I no sooner felt than I sought to understand. Repeated meditations led me first to suspect that fancy and imagination were two distinct and widely different faculties, instead of being, according to the general belief, either two names with one meaning, or, at furthest, the lower and higher degree of one and the same power. Thus Coleridge owed his interest in imagination to Wordsworth. Then the other subheading, Associationist Psychology. In the first stage of his development, Coleridge came under the spell of the Associationist Psychology of David Hartley and David Hume. The Associationist gave a mechanist view of the formation of human character and personality. The mind receives impressions of the external world through the senses. Such sense perceptions, impressions, and sensations are compounded by the mind into ideas, and simple ideas are compounded into ideas of greater and greater complexity. Sensations of pleasures get associated in course of time with certain actions and objects. Such actions, because they are pleasurable, are repeated, and repetition makes them habitual. In this way is the character of a growing child formed. Thus only wise passiveness, a passive receptivity to external impressions, is needed for the evolution and formation of our moral character from childhood to manhood. According to Associationist theory, the human mind or imagination is reduced merely to a passive and inactive recipient of impressions and sensations from the outside world. The point C, German philosophy. After his German tour undertaken with Wordsworth in 1879 to 1980, Coleridge came under the influence of the German philosophers, who took a more active view of the imagination. For them, the human mind or imagination is not a mere passive agent, but an active and creative power. He rejected the Associationist view of imagination and henceforth subscribed to the Kantian view of imagination as an esemplastic power, that is, an active power which shapes, molds, and recreates. Art is not a mere imitation of nature, it is recreation. Beauty is nothing objective. It is imparted to the external world by the observer. In the apprehension of beauty, the soul projects itself into the outward forms of nature. In this way, the external is made internal and internal is made external. The soul of artistic fuses with external reality and transforms and recreates it. It is the idea which fuses and unites. The other subheading of this chapter is Coleridge's originality. Thus, Coleridge's theory of imagination is derived largely from the German idealist philosophers. Indeed, such is the indebtedness of Coleridge to these sources that the charge of plagiarism has been often brought against him. Rein Wallach briefly examines this charge of plagiarism and concludes that many or most of Coleridge's key terms and distinctions are derived from Germany. But Coleridge is not a plagiarist. He was a highly original genius. He might have borrowed from others, but what he borrowed, he made it entirely his own. His originality is seen in the selection, the arrangement, the ordering, the modifications to which he subjected the borrowed material and in this way transformed it and made it entirely his own. In spite of his indebtedness to Germany, he is one of the most original critics of England. Then another subheading and point 4. Coleridge on imagination and fancy. Comparison with Wordsworth. In chapter 13 of Biographia Literaria, Coleridge writes, "The imagination then I consider either as primary or secondary. The primary imagination I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception and as a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. The secondary I consider as an echo of the former, coexisting with the conscious will, yet still as identical with the primary in the kind of its agency and differing only in degree and in the mode of its operation." It dissolves, diffuses, dissipates in order to recreate, or where this process is rendered impossible, yet still, at all events, it struggles to idealize and to unify. It is essentially vital, even as all objects are essentially fixed and dead. Fancy, on the contrary, has no other counters to play with but fixities and definites. The fancy is indeed no other than a mode of memory emancipated from the order of time and space and blended with and modified that empirical phenomena of the will which he expresses by the word choice. But equally with the ordinary memory, it must receive all his materials ready-made from the law of association. In chapter 14 of the book, he calls imagination a magical and synthetic power and adds, "This power, first put in action by the will and understanding and retained under their irremissive, though binding, gentle and unnoticed control, reveals itself in the balance or reconciliation of opposite or discordant qualities, of sameness with difference, of the general with the concrete, the ideas with the image of individual, with the representative, the sense of novelty and freshness with old and familiar objects, a more than usual state of emotion with more than usual order, judgment ever awake and steady self-possession with enthusiasm and feeling profound or vehement, and while it bends and harmonizes the natural and the artificial, still subordinates art to nature, the manner to matter, and our admiration of the poet to our sympathy with the poetry. The next subheading of this chapter is Primary Imagination. The extracts clearly bring out Coleridge's view on the nature and function of imagination and the ways in which it is distinguished from fancy. According to Coleridge, imagination has two forms, primary and secondary. Primary imagination is merely the power of receiving impressions of the external world through the senses. It is the power of perceiving the objects of sense both in their parts and as a whole. It is an involuntary act of mind. The human mind receives impressions and sensations from the outside world. Consciously and involuntarily, it opposes some sort of order on those impressions, reduces them to shape and size, so that mind is able to form a clear image of the outside world. It is in this way that clear and coherent perception becomes possible. Then secondary imagination. The primary imagination is universal, it is possessed by all. The secondary imagination, on the other hand, may be possessed by others also, but it is the peculiar and distinctive attribute of the artist. It is the secondary imagination which makes artistic creation possible. Secondary imagination is more active and conscious in its working. It requires an effort of the will, volition and conscious effort. It works upon what is perceived by the primary imagination. Its raw material is the sensations and impressions supplied to it by the primary imagination. By an effort of the will and the intellect, the secondary imagination selects and orders the raw material and reshapes and remodels it into object of beauty. It is asymplastic, that is, a shaping and modifying power, which by its plastic stress reshapes objects of the external world and steeps them with a glory and dream that never was on sea and land. It is an active agent which dissolves, diffuses, dissipates in order to create. This secondary imagination is at the root of all poetic activity. It is the power which harmonizes and reconciles opposites, and hence Coleridge calls it a magical synthetic power. This unifying power of imagination is best seen in the fact that it synthesizes or fuses the various faculties of the soul, perception, intellect, will, emotion, and fuses the internal with the external, the subjective with the objective, the human mind with external nature, the spiritual with the physical or material. It is through the play of this unifying power that nature is colored by the soul of the poet, and soul of poet is steeped in nature. The identity which the poet discovers in man and nature results from the synthesizing activity of the secondary imagination. The primary and secondary imagination do not differ from each other in kind. The difference between them is of degree. The secondary imagination is more active, more a result of volition, more consciousness, and more voluntary than the primary one. The primary imagination, on the other hand, is universal, while the secondary is peculiar privilege enjoyed by the artist. The next subheading is Imagination and Fancy. Imagination and fancy, on the other hand, differ in kind. There are activities of two different kinds. Fancy is not a creative power at all. It only combines what it perceives into beautiful shapes, but like imagination, it doesn't fuse and unify. The difference between the two is the same as the difference between a mechanical mixture and a chemical compound. In a mechanical mixture, a number of ingredients are brought together. They are mixed up, but they do not lose their individual properties. They still exist as separate identities. In a chemical compound, on the other hand, the different ingredients combine to form something new. The different ingredients no longer exist as separate identities. They lose their respective properties and fuse together to create something new and entirely different. A compound is an act of creation, while a mixture is merely a bringing together of a number of separate elements. Thus, imagination creates new shapes and forms of beauty by fusing and unifying the different impressions it receives from the external world. Fancy is not creative. It is a kind of memory. It arbitrarily brings together images, and even when brought together, they continue to retain their separate and individual properties. They receive no coloring or modification from the mind. It is merely mechanical juxtaposition, juxtaposition, and not a chemical fusion. Coleridge explains the point by quoting two passages from Shakespeare's Venus and Adonis. The following lines from this poem serve to illustrate fancy. Full gently now she takes him by the hand, a lily prisoned in a goal of snow, or ivory in an alabaster band. So white a friend in guards, so white a foe. In these lines, images are drawn from memory, but they do not interpret into one another. The following lines from the same poem, Venus and Adonis, illustrate the power and function of imagination. Look how a bright star soothed from the sky. So glides he in the night from Venus' eye. How many images and feelings, say Coleridge, are here brought together without effort and without discord. The beauty of Adonis, the rapidity of flight and yearning yet helplessness of the enamored gazer, and a shadowy ideal character thrown over the whole. For Coleridge, fancy is the drapery, that is the dress of poetic genius, but imagination is its very shawl, which forms all into one graceful and intelligent whole. The other subheading is Originality of Coleridge's Views, Comparison with Wordsworth. Coleridge owed his interest in the study of imagination to Wordsworth. But Wordsworth was interested only in the practice of poetry and he considered only the impact of imagination on poetry. Coleridge, on the other hand, is interested in the theory of imagination. He is the first critic to study the nature of imagination and examine its role in creative activity. Secondly, while Wordsworth uses fancy and imagination almost as synonyms, Coleridge is the first critic to distinguish between them and define their respective roles. Thirdly, Wordsworth doesn't distinguish between primary and secondary imagination. Coleridge's treatment of the subject is, on the whole, characterized by greater depth, penetration, and philosophical subtlety. It is his unique contribution to literary theory. Now the next heading, next subheading and fifth point is the definition, nature and function of poetry. Poetry and poem, the place and significance of meter. Coleridge's view of poetry has been elaborated in chapter 14 of the Biographia Literaria. He poses a number of questions regarding the nature and function of poetry and then answers them. He also examines the ways in which poetry differs from other kinds of artistic activity and the role and significance of meter as an essential and significant part of a legitimate poem. Prose and poetry differentiated. He begins by emphasizing the difference between prose and poetry. A poem contains the same elements as a prose composition. Both use words. The difference between a poem and a prose composition cannot, then, lie in the medium, for each employs the same medium, words. It must, therefore, consists in a different combination of them, in consequence of a different object being proposed. A poem combines words differently because it is seeking to do something different. Of course, all it may be seeking to do may be to facilitate memory. You may take a piece of prose and cast it into rhymed and metrical form in order to remember it better. And rhyming tags of that kind, with their recurring sounds and quantities, yield a particular pleasure too, though not of a very high order. If one wants to give the name of poem to a composition of this kind, there is no reason why one should not. But we should note that, though such rhyming tags have the charm of meter and rhyme have been superadded. Coleridge is ironically using Wordsworth's term. They do not arise from the nature of the content, but have been imposed on it in order to make it more easy memorized. The other subheading of this chapter is the function of poetry, its distinctive pleasure. The superficial form, the externalities, provide, however, no profound logical reason for distinguishing between different ways of handling language. A difference of object and content supplies an additional ground of distinction. The philosopher will seek to differentiate between two ways of handling language by asking what each seeks to achieve and how that aim determines its nature. The immediate purpose may be the communication of truth or the communication of pleasure. The communication of truth might, in turn, yield a deep pleasure. We may get a profound pleasure from reading a work of science or history. But Coleridge insists one must distinguish between the ultimate and the immediate end. Similarly, If the immediate aim be the communication of pleasure, truth may nevertheless be ultimate end, and while in an ideal society, nothing that was not truth could yield pleasure, in society, as it has always existed, a literary work might communicate pleasure without having any concern with truth, either moral or intellectual. The proper kind of distinction between different kinds of writing can thus be most logically discussed in terms of the difference in immediate aim or function of each. The immediate aim of poetry is to give pleasure. The next subheading is meter, organic to poetry. But the communication of pleasure may be the immediate object of a work not metrically composed. In novels, for example, do we make these into poems simply by superadding meter with or without rhyme? To which Coleridge replies by emphasizing a very important principle. You cannot derive truth and permanent pleasure out of any feature of a work which does not arise naturally from the total nature of that work. To superadd, meter is to provide merely a superficial decorative charm. Nothing can permanently please which does not contain in itself the reason why it is so, and not otherwise. If meter be superadded, all other parts must be made constant with it. Rhyme and meter involve an exact correspondent recurrence of accent and sound, which in turn are calculated to excite a perpetual and distinct attention to each part. A poem, therefore, must be an organic unity in the sense that while we note and appreciate each part to which the regular recurrence of accent and sound draw attention, our pleasure in the whole develops cumulatively out of such appreciation, which is at the same time pleasurable in itself and conductive to an awareness of the total pattern of the complete poem. Thus, a poem differs from a work of scientific prose in having as its immediate object pleasure and not truth, and it differs from other kinds of writings which have pleasure and not truth as their immediate object by the fact that in a poem the pleasure we take from the whole work is compatible with and even led up to by the pleasure we take in each competent part. Therefore, a legitimate poem is a composition in which the rhyme and the meter bear an organic relation to the total work. In it, the parts mutually support and explain each other, all in their proportion, harmonizing with and supporting the purpose and non-influences of metrical arrangement. Thus, Coleridge puts an end for good to the age-old controversy whether the end of poetry is instruction or delight or both. Its aim is definitely to give pleasure, and further, poetry has its own distinctive pleasure arising from the parts, and this pleasure of the parts supports and increases the pleasure of the whole. The next subheading of this chapter is Poem and Poetry. Not only that, Coleridge also distinguishes a poem from poetry. According to Shawcross, this distinction between poetry and poem is not very clear, and instead of defining poetry, he proceeds to describe a poet, and from the poet he proceeds to enumerate the characteristics of the imagination. This is so because poetry for Coleridge is an activity of the poet's mind, and a poem is merely one of the forms of its expression, a verbal expression of that activity, and poetic activity is basically an activity of the imagination. As David Deutsch points out, poetry for Coleridge is a wider category than that of poem. That is, poetry is a kind of activity which can be engaged in by painters or philosophers or scientists, and is not confined to those who employ metrical language or even to those who employ language of any kind. Poetry in this larger sense brings the whole soul of man into activity, with each faculty playing its proper part according to its relative worth and dignity. This takes place whenever the secondary imagination comes into operation, whenever the synthesizing, the integrating powers of secondary imagination are at work, bringing all aspects of a subject into a complex unity, then poetry in this larger sense results. The employment of the secondary imagination is a poetic activity, and we can see why Coleridge is led from a discussion of a poem to a discussion of the poet's activity when he realized that for him the poet belongs to the larger company of those who are distinguished by the activity of their imagination. A poem is always the work of a poet, of a man employing the secondary imagination, and so achieving the harmony of meaning, the reconciliation of opposites, and so on, which Coleridge so stresses. But a poem is also a specific work of art produced by a special handling of language. The harmony and reconciliation resulting from the special kind of creative awareness achieved by the exercise of the imagination cannot operate over an extended composition. One could not sustain that blending and balance, that reconciliation of sameness with difference, of general with the concrete, the idea with the image, the individual with the representative, the sense of novelty and freshness with old and familiar objects, and so on for an indefinite period. A long poem, therefore, would not be all poetry. Indeed, Coleridge goes to the extent of saying that there is no such thing as a long poem. Rhyme and meter are appropriate to a poem considered in the larger sense of poetry because they are means. That is, though not the only means of achieving harmonization, reconciliation of opposites, and so forth, which, as we have seen, are objects of poetry in its widest imaginative meaning. The next subheading in this chapter is organic unity. In a legitimate poem, that is, in a poem which is poetry in the true sense of the word, there is perfect unity of form and content. The notion of such organic unity runs through all Coleridge's pronouncements on poetry. Rhyme and meter are not pleasure superadded, for nothing can permanently please which does not contain in itself the reason why it is so and not otherwise. Nothing that is superadded, merely stuck on for ornament or decoration can really please in a poem. Every one of its characteristics must grow out of its whole nature and be an integral part of it. Rhyme and meter are integrated to the poem, an essential part of it, because the pleasure of poetry is a special kind of pleasure. Pleasure which results both from the parts and the whole, and the pleasure arising from the parts augments the pleasure of the whole. Rhyme and meter are essential parts, for by their recurrence of accent and sound, they invite attention to the pleasure of each separate part and thus add to the pleasure of the whole. When, therefore, meter is thus in consonance with the language and content of the poem, it excites a perpetual and distinct attention to each part by the quick reciprocations of curiosity, still gratified and still re-excited, and carries the reader forward to the end by the pleasurable activity of the mind, excited by the attractions of the journey itself. There is no stopping for him on the way, attracted by the parts, nor any hastening forward to the end, unattracted by the parts. It is one unbroken pleasure trip from the parts to the whole. Then the other subheading is Coleridge's theory of poetry, its significance. Thus, Coleridge's contribution to the theory of poetry is significant. First, he puts an end for good to the age-old controversy between instruction and delight being the end of poetry, and establishes that pleasure is the end of poetry and that poetry has its own distinctive pleasure. Secondly, he explores the neoclassical view of poetry as imitation and shows that it is an activity of imagination which in turn is a shaping and unifying power which dissolves, dissipates and creates. Thirdly, he shows that in its very nature, poetry must differ from prose. He controverts Wordsworth's view that rhyme and meter are merely superadded and shows that they are an organic part of a poem in the real sense of the word. Now friends, the next subheading and sixth point in this chapter is rustic life as the proper theme of poetry, language and diction of poetry. Criticism of Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction. Wordsworth and Coleridge came together early in life. It was in 1796 that they were frequently together, and out of their mutual discussion arose the various theories which Wordsworth embodied in his preface to the Lyrical Ballads, and which he tried to put into practice in his poems. Coleridge claimed credit for these theories and said they were half the child of his brain. But later on, his views underwent a change. He no longer agreed with Wordsworth's theories and so criticized them in chapter 17 and 18 of the Biographia Literaria. Coleridge's criticism is the last word on the subject. It has not been improved upon up to date. Then, Wordsworth's views. First, reasons for his choice of rustic themes. In his preface, Wordsworth made three important statements, all of which have been objects of Coleridge's censor. First of all, Wordsworth writes that he chose law and rustic life because in that condition the essential passions of the heart find a better soil in which they can attain their maturity, are less under restraint, and speak a plainer and more emphatic language, because in that condition of life, our elementary feelings coexist in a state of greater simplicity, and consequently, may be more accurately contemplated and more forcibly communicated, because the manners of rural life germinate from those elementary feelings and from the necessary character of rural occupations are more easily comprehended and are more durable, and lastly, because in that condition the passions of man are incorporated with beautiful and permanent forms of nature. Then B. Choice of rustic language. Secondly, that the language too of these men is adopted, purified indeed from what appear to be its real defects, from all lasting and rational causes of dislike or disgust, because such men hourly communicate with the best objects from which the best part of language is originally derived, and because from their rank in society and the sameness and narrow circle of their intercourse being less under the action of society vanity, they convey their feelings and notions in simple and unelaborated expressions. Point C. Diction of poetry. Thirdly, he made a number of statements regarding the language and diction of poetry. Of these, Coleridge controverts the following parts: a selection, or the real language of men, the language of these men, that is, men in low and rustic life. I propose to myself to imitate, and as far as possible to adopt, the very language of men, and between the language of prose and that of metrical composition, there neither is nor can be any essential difference. The other subheading is Coleridge's criticism. Themes of poetry. As regards the first statement, that is, the choice of rustic characters and life, Coleridge points out first that not all Wordsworth's characters are chosen from low or rustic life. Characters in poems like Ruth, Michael, the brothers are not low and rustic in the usual acceptance of these words. Secondly, their language and sentiments do not necessarily arise from their abode or occupation. They are attributable to causes which would result in similar sentiments and language. Even if these characters were living in a different place and carrying on different occupations, these causes are primarily two. First, independence, which rises a man above servility and a frugal life and industrious domestic life, and B, a solid religious education, which makes a man well versed in the Bible and other holy books to the exclusion of other books. The admirable qualities we notice in the language and sentiments of Wordsworth's characters result from these two causes, and not from their rural life and occupation, or their contemplation of nature. Even if they lived in the city, away from nature, they could have similar sentiments and similar language, if they were subject to the two causes mentioned by Wordsworth. In the opinion of Coleridge, a man will not be benefited from a life in rural solitudes unless he has A. natural sensibility, and B. suitable education. In the absence of these advantages, in a rural condition, the mind hardens and a man grows selfish. sensual, gross, and hard-hearted. Coleridge agrees with Aristotle's view that characters of poetry must be universal and typical. They must represent some particular class as well as general human nature. He writes, "Poetry is essentially ideal, that it avoids and excludes all accidents, that it apparent individualities of rank, character, or occupation must be representative of a class, and that the persons of poetry must be clothed with generic attributes, with the common attributes of the class, not with such as one gifted individual might possibly possess, but such as from his situation it is most probably beforehand that he would possess." Wordsworth's characters are representative in this sense. Then other subheading is rustic language. As regards the sound statement of Wordsworth, Coleridge objects to the view that the best part of the language is derived from the objects with which the rustic overly communicates. First, communication with an object implies a reflection on it, and the richness of vocabulary arises from such reflection. Now, the rural conditions of life do not require any reflection. Hence, the vocabulary of the rustics is poor. They can express only the barest facts of nature and not the ideas and thoughts, universal laws, which result from reflection on such facts. Secondly, the best part of a man's language doesn't result merely from communication with nature, but from education, from the mind's dwelling on noble thoughts and ideals of the masterminds of humanity. Whatever noble and poetic phrases, words, and arrangement of words the rustics use are derived not from nature, but from repeated listening to the Bible and to the sermons of noble and inspired preachers. The other subheading is poetic diction. Coming then to a detailed consideration of Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction, he takes up his statements one by one and demonstrates that his views are not justified. Wordsworth asserts that the language of poetry is a selection of the real language of man, or the very language of man, and that there was no essential difference between the language of prose and that of poetry. Coleridge retorts that every man's language varies according to the extent of his knowledge, the activity of his faculties, and the depth or quickness of his feelings. Every man's language has, first, its individual peculiarities, secondly, the properties common to the class to which he belongs, and thirdly, words and phrases of universal use. No two men of the same class or of different classes speak alike, although both use words and phrases common to them all, because in one case their natures are different and in the other their classes are different. This applies as much to the language of rustics as to that of townsmen. In both cases, the language varies from person to person, class to class, place to place. Which of these varieties of language, asks Coleridge, is the real language of man? Each, he replies, has to be purged of its uncommon or accidental features, such as those picked up from family, profession, or locality, before it can become the ordinary, that is, generally spoken, language of man. Omit the peculiarities of each, and the result, of course, must be common to all. And assuredly assuredly and assuredly the omissions and changes to be made in the language of before it could be transferred to any species of poem except the drama or other professed imitation are at least as numerous and weighty as would be required in adapting to the same purpose the ordinary language of tradesmen and manufacturers. Such a language alone has a universal appeal and is, therefore, the language of poetry. A language so generalized, so selected, and also purified of all that is gross and vulgar will differ in no way from the language of any other man of common sense. Coleridge objects to Wordsworth's use of the words very or real and suggests the ordinary or generally ought to have been used. Wordsworth's addition of the words in a state of excitement is meaningless, says Coleridge, for emotional excitement may result in a more concentrated expression, but it cannot create a noble and richer vocabulary. To Wordsworth's contention that there is no essential difference between the language of poetry and that of prose, Coleridge replies that there is and there ought to be an essential difference between the language of prose and that of poetry. The language of poetry differs from that of prose in the same way in which language of prose differs and ought to differ from the language of conversation, and as reading differs from talking. Coleridge gives a number of reasons in support of his view. First, language is both a matter of words and the arrangement of those words. Now, words, both in prose and poetry, may be the same, but their arrangement is different. This difference arises from the fact that the poetry uses meter, and meter requires a different arrangement of words. As Coleridge has already shown, meter is not a mere superficial decoration, but an essential organic part of a poem. Hence, there is bound to be an essential difference between the language, that is, the arrangement of words of poetry and prose. There is this difference even in those poems of Wordsworth which are considered most Wordsworthian. In fact, meter medicates the whole atmosphere, and so even the metaphors and similes used by a poet are different in quality and frequency from those of prose. Further, it cannot be demonstrated that language of prose and poetry are identical and so convertible. There may be certain lines or even passages which can be used both in prose and poetry, but not all. There are passages which will suit the one and not the other. To quote his own words, for the question is not whether there may not occur in prose or order of words which would be equally proper in a poem, nor whether there are not beautiful lines and sentences of frequent occurrence in good poems which would be equally becoming as well as beautiful in good prose, for neither the one nor the other has ever been either denied or doubted by anyone. The true question must be whether there are not modes of expression, a construction, and an order of sentences which are in their fit and natural place in a serious prose composition, but would be disproportionate and heterogeneous in metrical poetry, and vice versa, whether in the language of a serious poem there may not be an arrangement both of words and sentences, and a use and selection of what are called figures of speech, both as to their kind, their frequency, and their occasions, which on a subject of equal weight would be vicious and align in correct and manly prose. Thus does Coleridge refute Wordsworth's views on the themes and language of poetry. The next subheading and the seventh point, willing suspension of disbelief, dramatic illusion, comparison with Dr. Johnson. Views of Coleridge. No phrase in the language has acquired such wide and universal popularity and has had such a profound impact on subsequent literary theory as Coleridge's phrase, willing suspension of disbelief, which he used to indicate the nature of poetic dramatic illusion. All through the neoclassic era, the question of dramatic illusion and credibility had exercised the mind of critics, and the observance of the unities was considered essential, for it was said their violation puts too severe a strain on the credibility of the audience, and thus dramatic illusion is violated. The topic was hotly debated, and both Dryden and Dr. Johnson have expressed their views on it, views which are in advance of those of their contemporaries. However, it was Coleridge who said the last word on the subject and finally put the controversy at rest. Coleridge uses the phrase in connection with his account in chapter 14 of the Biographia Literaria of the origin and genesis of the lyrical ballads. He writes, "In his idea originated the plan of the lyrical ballads, in which it was agreed that my endeavors should be directed to persons and characters supernatural or at least romantic, yet so as to transfer from our inward nature a human interest and a semblance of truth sufficient to procure for these shadows of imagination that willing suspension of disbelief for the moment which constitutes poetic faith." Thus he was to treat of characters supernatural, which are incredible and improbable, and which under normal circumstances we would not believe in, but treatment was to be such that as long as we were reading his poems, there would be a willing suspension of disbelief, and we would believe for the moment in what is essentially incredible and improbable. In other words, the treatment should be such as would send the judgment of readers to sleep, so to say, so that they would pursue the poem with delight. In chapter 23 of Biographia Literaria, he explains himself further and writes, "The poet doesn't require us to be awake and believe. He solicits us only to yield ourselves to a dream, and this too with our eyes open and with our judgment perdue behind the curtain, really to awaken us at the first motion of our will, and meantime only not to disbelief. The poet sends our judgment to sleep, for as long as we are reading his work or seeing his play in the theater, he doesn't ask us to believe in what is presented to our mind. He only requires that we should not disbelieve. Only a momentary suspension of disbelief is required for an enjoyment of imaginative literature. We are not under any illusion that it is reality. Only for the moment there is a voluntary remission of judgment, such as happens during a dream. Our judgments are asleep, and so we enjoy what we dream of. Similarly, the poet, if he is sufficiently skillful, sends our judgments to sleep so that we neither believe nor disbelieve it to be reality, but merely enjoy what is presented to the mind's eyes. Our reason, our rational judgment, our consciousness is in voluntarily suspension, and this suspension of judgment enables us to enjoy what in our waking moments, when the spell is broken, we would condemn as incredible. Distancing in time and place, humanizing of the marvelous and the supernatural, etc., are some of the devices used to procure such willing suspension of disbelief. The next subheading is Views of Dr. Johnson, a Comparative Study. Further light on Coleridge's view in this connection is thrown through a comparison with the view of Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson was of the view that the reader or the spectator deludes himself into believing a play to be a reality as long as he is witnessing it. The spectator knows from the first to the last that the stage is only a stage and that the players are only players. But knowing, he deludes himself and regards it as the reality. But unlike Johnson, Coleridge is of the view that it is not in this state that a tale or a play is enjoyed, or that the reader or the spectator allows himself to be deluded even temporarily to be able to enjoy it. On the contrary, he just takes leave of his judgment for the time being. The true stage illusion consists not in the mind's judging it to be a forest, but in its remission of the judgment that it is not a forest. While Dr. Johnson believed that the spectator is in full exercise of his judgment and knows that what is being presented to him is not reality, Coleridge believes that the spectator doesn't voluntarily exercise his judgment for the time being. His critical faculty is asleep, so to say. Thus, Coleridge's position is a middle one. The spectator or the reader does neither actively believe nor disbelieve. His judgment is in a state of suspension, so to say, for the time being. Voluntarily, he is persuaded not to exercise it as long as he is reading a poem or witnessing a play. Imaginative literature owes its appeal to such suspension of disbelief. The 8th point and the next subheading is An Assessment of Coleridge as a Critic, His Greatness, His Achievement, His Influence. View of Critics. Coleridge is one of the greatest of literary critics, and his greatness has been almost universally recognized. He occupies, without doubt, the first place among English literary critics. Then, the other subheading, His Practical Criticism, Father of Impressionistic Criticism. A man of stupendous learning, both in philosophy and literature, ancient as well as modern, and refined sensibility and penetrating intellect, Coleridge was eminently fitted to the task of critic. His practical criticism consists of his evaluations of Shakespeare and other English dramatists and of Milton and Wordsworth. Despite the fact there are so many digressions and repetitions, his practical criticism is always illuminating and highly original. It is rich in suggestions of far-reaching value and significance and flashes of insight rarely to be met with in any other critic. His greatness is well brought out if we keep in mind the state of practical criticism in England before him. The neoclassic critics judged on the basis of fixed rules. They were either legislative or judicial, or were carried away by their prejudices. Coleridge doesn't judge on the basis of any rules. He does not pass any judgment, but gives his responses and reactions to a work of art. His criticism is impressionistic romantic, a new kind of criticism, a criticism which dealt a knockout blow to neoclassic criticism and has been in vogue more or less ever since. He could discover new beauties in Shakespeare and could bring about fresh revaluations of a number of old English masters. Similarly, his criticism of Wordsworth and his theories enable us to judge him and his views in the correct perspective. Then, the other subheading, philosophized literary criticism. In the field of theoretical inquiry, Coleridge was the first to introduce psychology and philosophy into literary criticism. He was interested in the study of the process of poetic creation, the very principles of creative activity, and for his purposes freely drew upon philosophy and psychology. He thus made philosophy the basis of literary inquiry and thus brought about a union of philosophy, psychology, and literary criticism. His literary theories have their basis in philosophy. He imparted to criticism the dignity which belongs to philosophy. He philosophized literary criticism and thus brought about a better and truer understanding of the process of creation and the nature and function of poetry. Next subheading, theory of imagination revolutionized the concept of imitation. His greatest and the most original contribution to literary criticism is his theory of imagination. Edison had examined the nature and function of imagination, had Wordsworth too had developed his own theory on the subject, but all previous discussions of imagination look superficial and childish when compared with Coleridge's treatment of the subject. He is the first critic to differentiate between imagination and fancy, the first literary critic to distinguish between primary and secondary imagination. Though his theory of imagination, he revolutionized the concept of artistic imitation. Poetic imitation is neither a servile copy of nature, nor it is the creation of something entirely new and different from nature. Poetry is not imitation, but creation, but it is creation based on sensations and impressions received from the external world. Such impressions are shaped, ordered, modified, and opposites are reconciled and harmonized by the imagination of the poet, and in this way, poetic creation takes place. The next subheading, demonstration of the organic wholeness of poetry. Further, as David Deutches points out, it was Coleridge who finally, for the first time, resolved the age-old problem of the relation between form and content of poetry. Through his philosophical inquiry into the nature and value of poetry, he established that a poem is an organic whole and that its form is determined by its content and is essential to that content. Thus, meter and rhyme, he showed, are not merely pleasures superadded, not merely something superfluous which can be dispensed with, not mere decoration, but essential to that pleasure which is the true poetic pleasure. This demonstration of the organic wholeness of a poem is one of his major contributions to literary theory. Next heading is willing suspension of disbelief. Similarly, his theory of willing suspension of disbelief marks a significant advance over earlier theories on the subject. His view that during the perusal of a poem or witnessing of a play, there is neither belief nor disbelief, but a mere suspension of disbelief, is now universally accepted as correct, and the controversy on the subject has been finally set at rest. Then the last subheading of this chapter, his related recognition and influence, its causes. However, it may be mentioned in the end that as Coleridge's views are too philosophical, he is a critic not easy to understand. Often it is fragmentary and unsystematic. Victorians in general could not appreciate him, and his appeal was confined to the few, says George Watson. In this connection, Coleridge's aesthetics could not appeal to a generation of Victorians to whom no system of aesthetic was of much interest. As a descriptive critic, his achievement is brilliant but sporadic, and he offers no single example worthy to be advanced as a model. If his criticism survives, as it vigorously does, it is not by virtue of what it demonstrates, but by what it abundantly suggests, for no English critic has so excelled at providing profitable points of departure for 20th century critics. Perhaps there is something perverse about a professional pundit who had so little to say that was comprehensible to his own century, but 100 years later his manuscripts, as they belatedly see print, seem among the richest of our capital assets. They are the relics of a mind passionately in love with free inquiry, concentrated and disciplined in its determination to decipher the secret of poetic discourse. It was only in the 20th century that his literary criticism has truly been understood, and recognition and appreciation have followed. Today, his reputation stands very high, and many go to him for inspiration and illumination. Despite the fragmentary nature of his work, he is now regarded as the most original critic of England. Friends, thus we come to the end of this chapter, that is Romantic Criticism, Coleridge.